Ayrım 11.
For firstly, Calvin too presents a God of those goodness we cannot judge and whose commandments we cannot interpret as designed to bring us to the telos to which our own desires point. As with Luther, so with Calvin, we have to hope for grace that we may be justified and forgiven for our inability to obey the arbitrary fiats of a cosmic despot. Secondly, even where Calvin appears most at odds with Luther, in his treatment of the realm of the secular, there is an inner identity. Luther took St. Paul's attitude to the bureaucrats of the Roman Empire as the model for his own attitude to the Elector of Saxony. Calvin took the attitude of the prophets to the kings of Israel and Judah as his model in dealing with the magistrates of Geneva. But although Calvin's theocracy makes clergy sovereign over princes, it sanctions the autonomy of secular activity at every level where morals and religious practice do not directly conflict with such activity. Provided that sex is restrained with the bounds of marriage and that church-going is enforced on Sundays, political and economic activity can proceed effectively unchecked by any sanctions whatsoever. Only the most obviously outrageous are ever condemned, and the history of Calvinism is the history of the progressive realization of the autonomy of the economic. Luther, like Calvin, bifurcated morality. There are, on one hand, the absolutely unquestionable commandments, which are, so far as human reason and desires are concerned, arbitrary and contextless, and on the other hand, there are the self-justifying rules of the political and economic order. The individual is the subject of both realms. Individual precisely because he is defined as against the God who creates him and as against the political and economic order to which he is subordinated. For the first time, wrote J. N. Figgis of the period immediately after the Reformation, the absolute individual confronts the absolute state. Footnote: the discussion of his theme by J. N. Figgis in the From Gerson to Grotius is still unsurpassed. The state becomes distinct from society. In the Middle Ages, social ties and political ties have a unity, just as they did for the Greeks, even if the unity of feudalism and the unity of the polis were quite different. A man is related to the state not via a web of social relations, binding superiors and inferiors in all sorts of ways, but just as subject. A man is related to the economic order not via a well-defined status in a set of linked associations and guilds, but just as one who has the legal power to make contracts. Of course, this social process of transition from status to contract is not only slow and uneven, it never takes place once for all. Time and again, different sections of the community experience the shock of the dissolution of patriarchal ties. Time and again, consciousness of the free market and the absolute state is sharpened. But in every case, what emerges is a new identity for the moral agent. In traditional societies and even in the Greek polis or under feudalism, a man defines himself in terms of a set of established descriptions by means of which he situates and identifies himself vis-à-vis other men. One reason why it is highly misleading to talk of a logical gulf between value and fact is that it suggests that in every society, it is equally true that we can first set out the facts of the social order, and then as a second, logically independent task, inquire how in this society one ought to behave. But this could only be true for all societies if it was always necessarily the fact that one could describe a social order without making use of the concepts of duties and obligations. Whereas, in fact, for many societies, we cannot provide a specification of the minimal social identity of an individual as son of a chief or a villain or member of such and such class or family, let alone of his full social role, without specifying him as having such and such obligations or duties. To this, the reply will be that the fact that in such a society, such a man is held to have certain duties can only be a fact about that society. It does not commit us to say that the man ought to perform them. But this is again highly misleading, for it implies that it is possible to say, for example, it is not true that a son of a chief ought to do such and such. But in the language of the tribe, this is simply a false evaluative statement, and in the language which we use to describe the tribe, it is simply a false descriptive statement. What, of course, is true is that we can characterize the life of the tribe without accepting their values. But this implies not that we can discuss independently of their stock of social descriptions how in this kind of society one ought to behave, but rather that we can always raise the additional question of whether this kind of society's continuance is a good or bad thing. What we often cannot do is characterize their social life in their factual terms and escape their evaluations. There are, of course, many societies where the language of factual description is such that it avoids commitment to evaluation in this way, and the transition from the traditional forms of pre-capitalist society in Western Europe to the individualist and mercantile society of early capitalism is a transition of this kind. It is therefore not just that Aquinas' Christian Aristotelianism and Luther's Christian Fideism are based on alternative and competing metaphysical schemes. It is also the case that they are providing an analysis of and insight into different moral vocabularies. Of course, in the case of Luther particularly, the analysis which is implicit in his preaching is causally efficacious. Luther makes sense of the moral experience of his hearers, and in so doing, leads to the acceptance of a framework in which their experience comes to be interpreted in stock Lutheran ways. The crucial feature of the new experience is that it is the experience of an individual who is alone before God. When Luther wants to explain what an individual is, he does so by pointing out that when you die, it is you who die, and no one else can do this for you. It is as such stripped of all social attributes, abstracted, as a dying man is abstracted, from all his social relations, that the individual is continually before God. Thus the individual no longer finds his evaluative commitments made for him, in part at least, by simply answering the question of his own social identity. His identity now is only that of the bearer of a given name who answers as a matter of contingent fact to certain descriptions, red-haired or blue-eyed, laborer or merchant, and he has to make his own choice among the competing possibilities. From the fact of his situation, as he is able to describe them in his new social vocabulary, nothing at all follows about what he ought to do. Everything comes to depend upon his own individual choice. Moreover, the sovereignty of individual choice is not only a consequence of his social vocabulary, but of the theorizing derived from theology. In Aristotelian ethics, as in the less explicitly formulated moralities of traditional societies, human needs and wants understood in various ways, provide the criteria for judging human actions. The Aristotelian account of the practical syllogism is a model here, where the major premise is always of the form that someone desires or needs or would benefit from something. Practical reasoning begins at this point, but the facts of human desires and needs can, in the 16th century, no longer provide a criterion for the choices of the moral agent or a major premise for his reasoning, at least if he takes seriously the charge of Lutherans and Calvinists alike that his desires are totally depraved. Even the popular theology of the Counter-Reformation takes a much blacker view of the human nature than Aquinas did, because all desires are corrupt, although, as always, sex usually takes the worst beating, with political rebellion its only close competitor, choice remains open. Between salvation and damnation, between profit and loss, between the multitude of competing policies which claim his attention, the individual has to choose. Three main concepts of moral import, therefore, emerge from the Reformation period. That of moral rules as being at once unconditional in their demands, but lacking any rational justification. That of the moral agent as sovereign in his choices. And that of the realm of secular power as having its own norms and justifications. It is not surprising either that the new concepts of rules and of the agent take on a new look when placed in this secular context. Moreover, the secular context had already found its own Luther. The author who is the Luther of secular power is Machiavelli. Like Luther, he has his medieval anticipators. Within the context of natural law, medieval theologians had often argued that certain political ends justified means that were normally not permitted. The removal of tyrants by assassination is a common example. Powick has explained how, from Frederick II and Philip the Fair onward, the next step was to identify the natural law of necessity with the natural impulses of a political community, its right to natural frontiers and self-assertion, or even to identify necessity not with natural law, but with the dictates of history. This trend, so far as realpolitik is concerned, was already adequately embodied in the medieval state, and the modern state has merely worsened realpolitik by being more powerful. But Machiavelli is its first theorist. A great deal of effort has been expended to show that, contrary to the Elizabethan dramatists, and in spite of his notorious admiration for Cesare Borgia, Machiavelli was not a bad man. This is partly because he was clearly an attractive personality, and it is widely, although incorrectly, felt that somehow one cannot be both bad and attractive. But more importantly, it is because Machiavelli's private and personal preferences were certainly for democracy, in his sense of the word, that is, extended limited rule, with small masters sharing power with large merchants, excluding, of course, servants and propertyless men, for generosity, honesty, and candor. But none of this must be allowed to confuse the issue. For Machiavelli, the ends of social and political life are given. They are the attainment and holding down of power, the maintenance of political order and general prosperity, and these latter, in part at least, because unless you maintain them, you will not continue to hold power. Moral rules are technical rules about the means to these ends. Moreover, they are to be used on the assumption that all men are somewhat corrupt. We may break a promise or violate an agreement at any time if it is in our interest so to do, For the presumption is that, since all men are wicked, those with whom you have contracted may at any time break their promises if it is in their interest. Men must act not as in some abstract way they think they ought to act, but as other men act. Since other men are influenced to some extent by generosity, clemency, and the like, these have their place. But still they only have their place as well-designed means to the ends of power. Machiavelli's is the first ethics, at least since some of the sophists, in which actions are judged not as actions, but solely in terms of their consequences. He is therefore committed to the view that consequences are calculable, and most of the Prince and the Discourses on Livy is devoted to explaining how this is so. The study of history yields empirical generalizations from which we can derive causal maxims. The use of these maxims is to influence other people. Here again, Machiavelli is both an heir of the sophists and an anticipator of modern writers. He must understand our evaluations as means to influence other people, rather than as answers to the question, what am I to do? It follows also that Machiavelli treats human behavior as governed by laws, and by laws of which the agents themselves are usually unconscious. For Machiavelli, it is possible to take a very simple view of these laws, since he is prepared to treat human nature, its motives and aspirations, as timeless and unchanging. Generalizations derived from the ancient Romans can be applied without difficulty to 16th century Florence. Nonetheless, the individual appears as starkly in Machiavelli as in Luther. He appears thus because society is not only the arena in which he acts, but also a potential raw material to be reshaped for the individual's own ends, law-governed but malleable. The individual is unconstrained by any social bonds. His own ends, not only those of power but also those of glory and reputation, are for him the only criteria of action, apart from the technical criteria of statecraft. Thus, we meet in Machiavelli for the first time what will become a familiar crux. The combination of an assertion of the sovereignty of the individual in his choices and his aims, with the view that human behavior is governed by unchanging laws. It is true that Machiavelli distinguishes between those whom he considers in the one capacity, ruler or potential rulers, and those whom he considers in the other, the ruled. But he is unconscious of any possible contradiction. Although he pays verbal obeisances to the distinction between ethics and politics, he makes clear the irrelevance of drawing it too sharply. Such a distinction depends upon there being a distinction between private and public life of such a kind that I can consider what it is best for me to do without considering in what political order it is requisite for me to live, either because I treat the political order as a given and unalterable context of private action, or because I think the political order irrelevant for some other reason. Machiavelli resembles Plato in making it clear on how many occasions ethics and politics merge, because from his age onward it becomes increasingly possible for more and more people to play a part in altering or modifying political institutions. The political order is less and less often a given and unalterable context. Because the power of the state continually grows, that power impinges more and more upon the private citizen and upon the alternatives between which he has to make his moral choices. Finally, there is a lesson to be learned from Machiavelli's example as much as from his explicit teaching. In periods in which the social order is relatively stable, all moral questions can be raised from within the context of the norms which the community shares. In periods of instability, it is these norms themselves which are questioned and tested against the criteria of human desires and needs. Both Plato and Aristotle, although they lived out the decline of the polis, take its form and its institutions more for granted than Machiavelli does the forms and institutions of the Italian city-state. Machiavelli is more aware of the external threats to Florence from the larger powers than Aristotle ever was of the threat of Macedon to Athens. Living in an age of flux, Machiavelli understood the transience of political orders, and it is this which in one way makes his appeal to the permanence of human nature so striking. For the counterpart to a belief in the transience of political and social orders might easily not have been a belief in a timeless human nature with permanent needs against which these orders can be measured and in terms of which they can be explained. It is, by now at any rate, clear that following the age of Luther and Machiavelli, we should expect the rise of a kind of moral cum political theory in which the individual is the ultimate social unit, power the ultimate concern, God an increasingly irrelevant but still inexpugnable being, and a pre-political, pre-social, timeless human nature the background of changing social forms. The expectation is fully gratified by Hobbes. Being in a gentleman's library, Euclid's Elements lay open, and 'twas the El Libri One. He read the proposition. By G... said he, he would now and then swear an emphatical oath by way of emphasis. This is impossible. So he reads the demonstration of it, which referred him back to such a proposition. Which proposition he read? That referred him back to another, which he also read. Et sic deinceps, and so on. That at last he was demonstratively convinced of that truth. This made him in love with geometry. Footnote. Lives, page 150. The writer is John Aubrey, the subject is Thomas Hobbes, and the year of the episode referred is 1629. Hobbes was already 41. His intellectual background to this date is symbolized by his rejection of Aristotle and his translation of Thucydides. The Aristotle who is rejected is the Aristotle of late degenerate scholasticism. The complaint against this Aristotle is that he confuses the investigation of the meaning of words with the investigation of the things for which words stand. And with this complaint, Hobbes rejects the whole Aristotelian epistemology of matter and form, essence and existence. In doing so, he believes that he is avoiding obfuscation. He is leaving himself with a universe composed only of concrete individuals, words, and the bodies which they signify. Yet, in fact, Hobbes' own investigations assume, and necessarily assume, the form of a conceptual inquiry, for he wishes to lay bare the notions of right, justice, sovereignty, and power. He finds a non-Aristotelian model for his inquiries in Euclid's Elements. The impulse for these inquiries was that which sent him to Thucydides. Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War was written, as Machiavelli's works were, in the belief that history can be instructive. It exhibits the downfall of Athens through the misdeeds of the Athenian democracy. The moral is the political corrosiveness of democracy, the villain Cleon the tanner, the archetype of envious and aspiring men. The England of the 1620s was full of envious and aspiring men. Not surprisingly, since the Great Price Revolution, which had begun in the previous century, had destroyed the traditional economic patterns of the English landholder. Fortunes were made and lost. Individuals rose in standing through adroit use of money. The relationships of small and large gentry, of great noblemen and their lesser dependents, were in flux. England stood on the edge of a market economy in which the feudal and aristocratic ties were in danger of being displaced by the cash nexus. The state power embodied in the crown stood in new and uncertain relationship to its subjects. The particular strand in the cash nexus, which taxation represents, was the point at which the crown's assertion of what it claimed were traditional duties met the subject's assertion of what they claimed were traditional rights. It is always a sobering thought that the income tax accountant, searching for legal loopholes for his business clients, is the spiritual descendant of Pym and Hampden. Hobbes foresees danger in the claim to rights against the crown and translates Thucydides as a solemn warning against the threat to sovereignty of rival and warring social factions. It is as the loyal subject of the Stuart kings that Hobbes translates the admirer of Pisistratus and Pericles. Yet Hobbes is entirely untypical in the manner of his intervention in the quarrels between the sovereign and his subjects. The hierarchical society of an earlier England is one in which personal, social, and political loyalties intermingle and support one another. Rights and duties are defined within a single, if complex, system. The justification of any particular move in the feudal game lies either in referring to the positions of the actors or to the rules of the game. What the economic revolutions, and particularly in England, the price revolution of the 16th and 17th century, bring about is a breaking of these ties. Most of the traditional social landmarks remain. What is questioned is their interrelationship. God is still believed in, and the priest is still in his parish. But one can question in a more radical way what links the priest to God. The elements of feudal society are all present. Servants and other propertyless men, small gentry, nobility, the king. What is in question is the mode of their interrelation. The age is ripe for theories of authority, and the two most popular sources of theorizing are the scriptures and history. The doctrine of the divine right of kings, with its model of King David, vies for biblical warrant with Presbyterian doctrines of ecclesiocracy, disguised as theocracy. The appeal to historical precedent is used to prop up both the doctrine of divine right and the doctrine that the sovereign is dependent on lords and commons. Hobbes appeals to neither. He breaks with the whole discussion by his appeal to a new method learned from Galileo, which will enable him not merely to understand the elements of social life, but to estimate the worth of appeals to history or to scripture. The method is that of resolving any complex situation into its logically primitive, simple elements, and then using the simple elements to show how the complex situation could be reconstructed. In doing this, we shall have shown how the situation is in fact constructed. This is the method which Hobbes took Galileo to have employed in the study of physical nature. In the case of physical nature, of course, the theoretical reconstruction of complexity out of simplicity has no moral function, But in the case of human society, the rectification of our understanding may provide a rectification of how we conceive our place in society and consequently of our beliefs as to how we ought to live. When society is resolved into its simple elements, what do we find? A collection of individuals, each of which is a system whose end is its own self-preservation. The fundamental human motives are the desire to dominate and the desire to avoid death. Men, from their very birth, and naturally scramble for everything they covet and would have all the world, if they could, to fear and obey them. Footnote: The English works of Thomas Hobbes, edited by W. Molesworth, 773. Continually to be outgunned is misery. Continually to outgo the next before is felicity. And to forsake the course is to die. Footnote: The English works of Thomas Hobbes, edited by W. Molesworth, 453. The only limitations upon a perpetual and restless stirring of power after power are death and the fear of death. The individuals who are driven by these motives know no rules except those precepts which instruct them in how they may preserve themselves. Before society exists, there is nothing but competition for domination, a war of each against all. Of this situation, it is true that where there is no common power, there is no law. Where no law, no injustice. Force and fraud are in war the two cardinal virtues. Nonetheless, reason instructs the individual that he has more to fear than to hope for from this war. Death is a more certain outcome than domination. To avoid death, he must exchange peace for war, agreement for competition, and those articles of agreement which reason urges as prudent, even in a state of nature, constitute the laws of nature. The first is that every man ought to endeavor peace as far as he has hope of obtaining it, and when he cannot obtain it, that he may seek and use all helps and advantages of war. The second, that a man be willing, when others are so too, as far forth as for peace and defense of himself he shall think it necessary, to lay down this right to all things, and be contented with so much liberty against other men as he would allow other men against himself. And the third, that men perform their covenants made. Footnote: The English works of Thomas Hobbes, edited by W. Molesworth, 3.130. Yet this is clearly not enough to assuage the fear of death. For while we may agree with other men in order to make ourselves mutually secure from each other's aggression, how can we be sure that others will abide by these agreements and not merely use them to lull us into a false sense of security so that they may then attack us more effectively? In the state of nature, there are no sanctions by means of which contracts may be enforced. And covenants, without the sword, are but words and of no strength to secure a man at all. Footnote: The English works of Thomas Hobbes, edited by W. Molesworth, 3.154. The commands of the sovereign power, whatever the political nature of that power, democratic, oligarchic, or monarchical, furnish a second set of precepts which demand obedience. The only limitations upon the obedience which the sovereign may demand is at the point where the motive for assenting to the transfer of power to the sovereign in the original contract, that is, the fear of death, becomes a motive for resisting the sovereign himself, namely at any point at which the sovereign threatens to take away one's life. Otherwise, the only point at which one may cease to owe the sovereign obedience is that at which the sovereign ceases to be able to perform the very function for which he was given the power in the first place, that of protecting the lives of his subjects. That is, the sovereign who becomes powerless is no longer owed obedience, is no longer indeed a sovereign. Rebellions are always wrong while they are unsuccessful. Successful rebellion, however, is the assumption of sovereignty and has all the justification of sovereignty behind it. It is because successful, not rebellion. The rules which bind the individual are therefore of two kinds, pre- and post-contract, natural and social. To use the word social is to be reminded of one of the oddest of Hobbes' confusions, that he appears not to distinguish the state and society, to make political authority not dependent upon the prior existence of, but constitutive of, social life. There are, of course, situations where the disappearance of the state's power of repression may lead to the rise of anarchic violence. But there are and have been plenty of situations where an orderly social life continues without such a power being present. Indeed, if one contrasts 18th, 19th, and 20th century urban life, where the state's repressive power is close at hand, with the moral life of those other periods, where it is often absent or far away, one might draw the conclusion that the state's presence is a demoralizing factor. This would be, at any rate, so far as the argument has taken us already, as ill-founded, because as one-sided a conclusion as Hobbes, but it underlines Hobbes' error. According to Hobbes, the social rules are rules which we obey for two kinds of reason. First, because they are enforced by the sanctions of the sovereign, and second, because our desires are such that we prefer to obey the sovereign in order to escape death at the hands of others, except where we are liable to incur it at the hands of the sovereign. The rules which constitute the law of nature we obey simply because they are precepts which tell us how to get what we want, domination, and avoid what we do not want, death. Both sets of rules are of the form, if you want to get X, you must do Y. They are thus factual statements which may be true or false, and they are selected out of the set of such statements for inclusion in the list of natural and social precepts because the desires named in the antecedent clauses are the desires which all men do, as a matter of contingent fact, have. Hobbes' position on this point has been attacked on two kinds of ground. The first of these attacks is misconceived. It is that moral rules are not the kind of prudential, factual statement that Hobbes makes them out to be, that moral rules are simply of the form you ought to do so and so, and contain no reference to desires or inclinations. What is quite true is that in some societies, notably in modern Western ones, such as our own, this form of moral rule has been predominant, but it is not at all clear why the adjective moral should be restricted to this form of rule. To this it may be replied by Hobbes' critics that the moral rules in fact used by Hobbes' contemporaries were of this form, and that Hobbes has simply misrepresented and misanalyzed them. The difficulty with this version of their contention is that it is difficult to know how to interpret utterances of the form "you ought ... where the absence of any hypothetical clause referring to desires may be due either to the fact that no such reference is intended or to the fact that such a reference is so clearly and commonly shared that it does not need to be made explicit. But it is important to note that Hobbes, in giving desires a central place in the moral picture, is at one with his predecessors. It is only gradually that Protestantism and other influences cause morality and desire to appear to be sharply contrasted. Hence, this attack on Hobbes is perhaps slightly anachronistic. That Hobbes did, however, misrepresent and misanalyze his contemporaries' use of moral rules remains true. Aubrey has a story of how, outside St. Paul's Cathedral, an Anglican clergyman who had seen Hobbes give alms to a poor man tried to improve the occasion by asking of Hobbes, who was reputedly impious and atheistic, if he would have given the alms, had not Christ commanded it. Hobbes' reply was that he gave the alms because not only did it please the poor man, but it pleased him to see the poor man pleased. Thus Hobbes tries to exhibit his own behavior as consistent with his theory of motives, namely that human desires are such that they are all self-interested. The kind of lie told by Hobbes, according to this anecdote, is a kind of lie indulged in more often by philosophers than by other men, a lie told in the interests of saving the face of a theory. It remains a lie and a culpable lie, although one that Hobbes needed to tell, for the root of his error is here. Human nature and human motives are not and cannot be what he says they are. According to Hobbes, any regard for the welfare of others is secondary to a regard for, and indeed is only a means to, my own welfare. In fact, both in ourselves and in others, we find other regarding and self-regarding motives side by side. What could justify us in representing the former as a secondary offspring of the latter? What justifies Hobbes is his view of the contract as intervening between the state of nature and social life. But what justifies his view of the contract? Not any historical or anthropological evidence that man ever is or was like this. Hobbes does, in passing, refer to the American Indians, but his whole argument is based on a method that makes him independent of historical evidence. He is resolving timeless human nature into its timeless elements, not recounting an evolutionary progress. The story of the contract must then be read as an extended metaphor, but it can only function even as a metaphor if it is an intelligible story, if it satisfied certain elementary requirements of logical coherence. This it fails to do. The Hobbesian contract is the foundation of social life in the sense that prior to the contract, there are no shared rules or standards. Indeed, the story of the contract functions as some kind of explanation of how men came to share social norms.